Succession number 10657, reel 39.
I think we just wave the farm cart, the driver, on his way. And Tony and I had a spot of lunch in the woods. I think they'd given us some salami at our previous night's stop. And we moved down to the banks of the River Po. There was a sawmill downstream, and Tony went off to contact one of the woodmen. Now, this chap told him that if we moved down towards the bridge, that's about 200 or 300 yards, you will find a boatman there to take you across the Po. This we did. And not long afterwards, a dilapidated old boat touched down only a few feet away from where we were hiding on the bank. It's obvious that they'd been watching from the other bank. They came straight to us. And I would imagine that quite a lot of other people had crossed the Po in a similar manner. I would imagine maybe there was some sort of signal given from the sawmill to the boat, and that the boat came across every time to that particular spot. But it was crewed by an old man and a young boy. They took us across. We could see the Germans on a bridge downstream. On the far bank, there were German infantry marching on a road parallel to the river and singing. But nobody was suspicious of the four people in the boat. There was nobody waiting for us on the far bank, no Germans, no Italian army or anything like that. We were delighted, of course. We gave the old man a tin of processed cheese to thank him for his efforts. Tony said, well, surely better idea to give him some money. We might need the cheese more than the money if we run short of food, which was a very good point. So Tony gave him some notes, asked for the cheese back, but the old boy was too clever for us, and he kept the cheese and the notes.
What sort of boat was this?
Oh, an old rowing boat, a dilapidated old rowing boat. I mean, it looked as though it was going to expire at any moment and sink. It really was. It had been condemned, I should think.
What was the river like at this stage?
Quite good. It wasn't rough or anything like that.
Was it flowing fast? Or
I don't know. I can't remember that. But I can't remember that we had any problem getting across or any problem getting into the boat or out of it. So it must have been fairly calm, I think.
Was it broad?
Very broad, the river, yes. It's quite. I don't know, but it's got to be... Oh, Lord, it's got to be... I would have thought half a mile across or something like that. It is a very wide river. Certainly was at this part, anyway.
There were no other craft on it.
Not that we saw at the time. No.
It's rather strange that the Germans weren't patrolling it, because it would have been an excellent.
Well, the Germans were patrolling the bridge.
But the river itself.
But they couldn't have done the whole river bank, I don't think, on both sides.
They might have had boats on the river.
They might have done, but I mean, I don't suppose. At that time, they were worried all that much about what might be happening. At a later stage, when the Allies reached the Po, that would have been a very different situation, I think. And it's only just a very few days after we'd made the break, in actual fact. Some little time after the armistice, though, wasn't it? Yes. Anyway, we didn't have any trouble from Germans on the bridge or on the bank. This third day's journey was in fact shorter than the previous two. By now we were pretty tired and weary, and we really wanted somewhere to hide up for a few weeks so that our wounds could heal and so that we could push on south faster. But although the Italians where we stayed were quite happy about one night, they were all very frightened about anything more than one night. That's at this stage as we're going through the country. And another communal farm we found that afternoon about 4 o'clock. Farmer and wife were very helpful from one of the farms. But there were two families of farm labourers living there. They agreed to hide us for the night in a hayloft. the two families between them had got 8 or 9 children, and we called these children the dead end kids. They were really unpleasant little urchins and very, very cruel to some little kittens that they had got there, sort of swinging them around by their tails and letting them go and that sort of thing. Then they burst out laughing, and their parents didn't take any notice. And I think it's another example, really, of how cruel the Italians can be on occasions. We had our evening meal with different families. Tony had his with one family, and I had mine with another. And then we met up afterwards, up to the hayloft. I was jammed up against a bale of hay all night, woke up with a stiff neck in the morning, and that particular hideout we called Dead End Kids. Day 4, we were up bright and early, and we used country tracks. For the first time, we stuck to the tracks all the time. We were getting more confident now, whereas before we tried to avoid the roads and the trees, which had probably slowed us down on those earlier days. And the kids were running up behind us and tugging at our coats, although we were well disguised, or so we thought, and calling out, "Inglese, Inglese." Farm labourers greeted us, and we wondered how many escapers... Well, here again, we just wondered how many had been able to travel through Italy before the armistice and had been able to fool the Italian peasants. I would have said that it was virtually impossible. Anyway, that afternoon, we were walking through a field, and 3 small children came rushing up, the usual business, tugged away at our coats, "Inglese, Inglese." Tony turned around and said, "Go away, you little beast." They didn't take any notice. And their older sister stopped us. She told us that a few days ago, 2 South African officers, making for the mountains, had spent the night, and would we like to stay the night? So we said, yes, we would. What we didn't realise, that they were making us work for our bread and butter. We had to cut the grapes from the vines for 3 hours in the grapevines, and we worked with the elder sister and 2 younger ones. And of course, this place we had to call 3 smart girls. It seemed to be appropriate.
How did she actually speak to you? Was it in English or in French?
Well, we picked up a little bit of Italian by now. That she probably, quite a lot of them speak French. You know, the funny thing is, in Modena itself, and I think it must be so to the north as well, the patio of Modena is very close to French. So the sort of local talk is very close to French. And we found that quite a lot of people did speak a bit of French. So I think it's very likely indeed that it was a mixture of French and English that she was able to tell us about these South African officers. Anyway, we were taken, after we'd finished this work in the grapevines, and I can tell you that we ate rather too many of the grapes, which gave us a certain amount of bowel troubles for the next couple of days, to say the least.
Presumably these were wine grapes.
Black grapes, yes. Yes, they were black. They were wine grapes, that's right. Mm. But it did upset our tummies quite a bit, actually. But we were taken to another large communal farm. We had a wash and brush up by the side of a well. And then, to our embarrassment, we were introduced to 2 of the sons at this communal farm, 2 of the sons of one of the families who had fought in North Africa. So we had to keep off the topic of North Africa, but I couldn't help wondering whether we'd face them at Gazala or Alamein or Marith or something like that. And it was rather strange, you know, sitting down over a meal and talking to 2 people who'd been our enemies not so long ago.
Wearing any
items,
uniform?
No. But anybody who could get out of uniform in the Italian army did so, or most of them anyway. And so they were back to working on the farm again.
What did they say about their experiences in North
Africa? They didn't say a thing, because the sister told us that they'd both been in North Africa tipped us off about that, so we didn't say anything about it, and neither did they. Maybe at some, at a later date or after the war, they would have been very, very interesting people to have spoken to. They could well have been in the southern sector of the Alamein Line or at Gazala. But we never did find out, and we kept off the subject, you know. So we come to the fifth day, and in the morning the mother of the girls said we could stay until lunch, whilst one of the daughters went into a nearby town to find out the situation, re the Germans, as to whether there were a lot of them around or not. And we made one of our famous Benja's pancakes, the hospital speciality, for the mother, from Benja's food in our Red Cross parcels. She produced a frying pan, and the kitchen was absolutely spotless. She was, I think, a little bit concerned about what we were going to do to her frying pan. Up to now, the other kitchens that we'd been in had all been pretty dirty, full of flies, and it was rather like the desert, and that the flies would remain on the piece of food you were eating until you almost got it in your mouth before they buzzed off. So it was rather nice to have this very, very clean kitchen. We finished the pancakes quite successfully, put some Red Cross syrup inside, again out of the Red Cross parcel, and gave the pancakes to the kids, to some of the younger children anyway. They were very pleased, and we left the rest of the tin of Benja's with the mother, together with instructions as to how to make the pancakes. She'd seen us making them anyway. Anyway, in the hour after lunch, we set off on what was to be the last lap of our journey. For the following day, we were to contact the Italian underground. We walked for a few hours, and a charming elderly farmer put us up for the night. We had a dry loft, we had a bed with sheets and blankets, and it was a great improvement. We listened to the BBC news bulletin again, and we thought to ourselves, what a good spot to lay up. Good living quarters and a wireless, comfortable bed and everything. And we stayed there the night. Now, on the morning of the sixth day, Tony's arm was proving very troublesome. I was getting a lot of pain from my shoulder, and we asked this elderly Italian if we could stay another day. He said no. He and his daughter were afraid of the Germans. We could stay until lunch, then we must leave. He was extremely sorry, but that was it, and we accepted that straight away. Fortunately, the underground had spotted us. Just before lunch, a grubby little boy brought a typewritten note in English to the farm, and we opened it, and in English it said, "Stay where you are among friends. Tonight you will be taken to a place of safety." So this was absolutely terrific news. We were able to stay until the evening. We were dirty. We hadn't shaved since leaving the train. And we really looked pretty down at heel. So Tony asked the farmer if he could help, and the Italian went into the local village, contacted a barber who was a member of the underground, brought the barber back to the house. He gave us a shave and shampoo, and we called this hideout Sweeney Todd. So that's the finish of that section. We've actually got almost to Modena.
Now, when you were on the move, getting dirty and so forth, you mentioned your wounds playing up and your companions were playing up.
Mm.
Had you managed to have your dressings changed?
No. But mine, I mean, when we got from the train, mine had just healed up, at least the exit hole in my back, which was about the size of my hand, actually. Very big at the back, as you know. And the one at the top wasn't too bad. But neither of them had sort of broken open or anything like that. But Tony had had a lot of wounds because he'd been shot up. Messerschmitt had chased him round a haystack when he'd been shot down over Sicily, and he'd been badly wounded, leg, arm, shrapnel that they'd thrown at him when he was escaping. before he got to Looker Hospital. In fact, his story was told in Brickhill's book, Escape or Die. So he'd got quite a lot of things that were paining him, and so did I. And I don't think we could have gone very much further without having some sort of medical assistance, which in fact was not very far away. There was nothing that, although we'd got bandages, it's no good asking, you know, people living on the farms if they could bind it up or anything. It probably wouldn't have stayed in position anyway. And as it wasn't actually bleeding or anything like that, we more or less carried on. But we'd got to the stage where something had got to be done about the various wounds. Until the underground arrived to pick us up. And they came that evening. Now, I mean, this was real cloak and dagger stuff, you know, that the sort of thing you'd expect to see on a film. I mean, two men came. They'd both got large hats and black cloaks, and they were riding bicycles. We had to get onto the handlebars of the bicycles. And they took us in the dark to a small village named Fabrico, F-A-B-R-I-C-O. Now, we were taken to a house in the village where the wife was a trained nurse. And our wounds were looked at. She provided more bandages and antiseptic ointment and more or less dressed my back quite well, and Tony as well. They gave us a jolly good meal at this particular house, and we were there for 3 days. We stayed there just until the housewife, the nurse, had finished looking after us, and after a good meal we went on to the house which was to be our home for the next 3 days. Now, this house was the HQ of the local underground. Our identity was pretty carefully checked. They asked us a lot of questions. Had we not been British, I think that they would have spotted it, actually, from the questions they were asking us. They went right back to, you know, not only who were you with, but where did you land in Sicily, etc., etc. And they did ask a lot of questions, and some of them, I think, would have uncovered us if we'd have been Germans masquerading as escapers.
Did they interrogate you in English?
Yes, this was a family of pretty... It was a pretty upper-class family, actually. Very wealthy people, and they did speak a bit of English and French. Tony spoke French quite well. I spoke a little. So a combination of English, French and Italian, we got on pretty well. We met the whole family. In fact, it was the Terzi family, T-E-R-Z-I, and the man who was the leader was Silvio Terzi, and his brothers were in the underground with him. They were all part of the underground. He told us that we'd got to wait here and that in a few days we'd be taken to a nearby town and lodged in a furnished flat. He said, you'll then be taken south either by rail or road. And they were very good to us indeed, these people. They provided food from the black market, and we fed extremely well. There was a small portable wireless in the house, and in the afternoon, and in the evenings rather, the whole family listened to variety programmes from London, which it was picking up quite well, and of course the news. Whilst we were watching listening to the radio, we got large chunks of fruit cake were produced and bottles of wine. The whole house was a very luxurious residence, in actual fact. We could have baths twice a day if we wanted them. Our bedrooms were heated, and this was really living it up, you know, on the grand scale. So we call this place the House of Rothschild. That's what that was described as. Now, I'll tell you the sort of things they gave us. They gave us money. We'd had a little bit of money on us, which we tried to give to the boatman. They fitted us out with lounge suits, black shoes, overcoats, Stetson hats, socks, shirts, handkerchiefs, underclothes, and toilet requisites. In other words, they completely replaced everything we'd been given at the first stopping place. Our peasant clothing, which was pretty smelly by now, was discarded, and we now looked like commercial travellers when we looked at ourselves in the mirror. Our uniform we put in small hand suitcases to be carried. Now, you'll probably say that we were taking a chance to do this, and we were, but the sort of suits we'd be fitted out with, the sort of suits we'd been fitted out with, I don't think you could have got the battle dress jackets under them without the whole thing looking very bulky. Whereas on the move with these rather large peasants' coats, it hadn't been such a problem. But on the afternoon of the third day of living in the House of Rothschilds, a man named Dr. Ottavio Corgini, C-O-R-G-I-N-I, arrived. He was a leading resident in Modena, actually, and I think he was also on the council or something like that. Quite a big man anyway. Now, he spoke perfect French, and he gave us instructions in French. He told us that the following morning we would go to the town of Modena by train, that we would have a guide called Pietro, that would be taken to the railway station by two men from the underground, that we weren't to speak to anybody, that the tickets would be bought for us, that we would walk through onto the platform on the far side and wait there until the train came in. It would be a train made up of cattle trucks and carriages, and we were to get in the cattle trucks, because where there were no corridors, there couldn't be any Germans checking. At this particular time, we did not have identity cards. So had we been questioned, I think we would have been unmasked straight away. We were told we mustn't speak to Pietro, although he'd be in the truck with us, and that at Modena, when we got there, we were to walk outside the station, and we would see Corgini bending down, doing up his shoelace. Both Tony and I, outside the station, were to light cigarettes so that he knew we'd seen him, and we were then to follow him, but on under no circumstances to catch him up. He also told us that at the station, Pietro would leave us because he wasn't allowed to see where we were taken. But that underground wasn't to know what the Modena underground was doing. Anyway. Yes, that's right. And I think, yes, this was pretty advanced thinking, actually. But certainly, Corgini knew our friends in Modena because he had discussed it with the Modena underground before he'd come to get us, in actual fact. But none of the other people, none of the rest of the Terzi family and Pietro didn't know where we were going to. The following morning, our two guides gave us another handlebar trip to the station. But by now, of course, we'd got these little suitcases, so it wasn't easy to get and stay on the handlebars. But they took us through the countryside, and as we came into the village of Rollo, R-O-L-L-O, not far from Modena, they pointed out houses where the owners were fascist sympathisers. And we thanked our lucky stars that we hadn't stopped at any of those houses. There were still some fascist sympathisers about in Italy. They didn't all go over to the Allied side, as it were. We cycled through Rollo, and you got the feeling again that everybody was staring at us. Guides bought the tickets, but on the platform it was mainly office workers. It was a sort of business train going from just outside London into London or something like that. And we had to wait 10 minutes for the train, during which time we tried to work out how we would get over the platform fence, which had got high palings, if we had to try and make a break. And we came to the conclusion that there was no way we could jump up there and get over. So we were really trapped on that platform. Anyway, the train came in. Sorry. Pietro climbed into the truck. We followed. Two German soldiers already in the truck. We moved into the shadows right at the back, read the paper, although we didn't understand a word of what was in it, and the Germans took no notice of us, probably going into Modena on leave. We followed them out of the truck, gave up our tickets. We saw Corgini on the far side of the road from the station entrance. We lighted up, and we started walking some distance behind Corgini, who took us in a very roundabout route through Modena. In fact, we passed the station, I think, on three occasions. So he was really making it very difficult for us to note where we'd gone. By now, Pietro had gone, and we came to a street called Via Ganacetto. We went into a courtyard through some big double doors from the street, up some stairs. Corgini knocked on the door. A peep hatch was pushed back. A password was given, and we were hustled into the house of a man named Mario Lugli, L-U-G-L-I, who was the leader of the Modena underground movement and a man who did tremendous good work for the Allies over a period of months. We, of course, relaxed. We really felt safe at last. And after we'd had coffee, which was produced by Mario's wife, who was a charming lady, we met two South African officers, a colonel and a major, Colonel Brits and Major Holdridge, who'd escaped from the nearby Modena prison camp and had been hiding in Via Ganacetto for several days. Although Mario didn't often put people up there, he did in emergency. The South Africans told us that a few days earlier, two British officers, Tom Rowarth, R-O-W-O-R-T-H, who at a later stage in the war joined SOE and was operating in northern Italy, and a man named Tug Wilson, I think from the Wiltshire Regiment, had gone south making for Rome. And in actual fact, they went into the Vatican in Rome. This was all organised. And they stayed there until Tom was able to get out back to our own lines and eventually joined SOE and was dropped. I didn't meet Tom until after the war, but I got to know him very well afterwards. Now, Brits and Holdridge told us we would await in Modena until it was safe for us to move south, and that later we would go to this furnished flat. And just before lunch, Mario escorted us to the flat of a man named Quinto Reggiani, R-E-G-G-I-A-N-I. We walked through Modena itself. We brushed shoulders with German officers and soldiers on leave doing their shopping. By now we felt 100% confident that they didn't know who we were. Certainly, the Germans didn't spot us. We were jolly well disguised by the Terzi family and quite happy. It was a 10-minute walk, and it was a furnished flat in Via Canalchiaro. We had to go up a couple of flights of stairs. Mario tapped three times on the door, and a youngster who lived not far away, named Peppino, let us in. He was going to be our guide on many occasions after this. We found that the flat had a lounge, two bedrooms, a kitchen, a bathroom. In the lounge was a wireless set, English playing cards, novels, and magazines. Mario told us that the food would be provided from the black market, but that we had to cook it. There was a bathroom with shaving things, toothbrushes. The bedroom was laid out with underclothes, shirts, socks, and on shoes. Now, all of these things were provided by the people of Modena. A Modena underground movement was not a gung-ho resistance outfit or partisans or anything like that. It was made up entirely of ordinary people living in Modena who were banded together by Mario to provide accommodation, food, lodging and everything for prisoners. So a very unusual type of what we called it underground, and it was, but it was in no way a fighting organisation. It was a life-saving one with ordinary people making their contributions. In fact, it was rather amusing because Mario said to me, he said, "Now, I've got you some pipe tobacco and cigarettes." They'd thought of everything, actually. And he said, "Would you like to have some marmalade. So we said, yes, marmalata, he said. And what, of course, they produced, it wasn't really marmalade. It was this awful glutinous jam in wooden tubs that was solid glutinous, actually. And marmalata, apparently, is the Italian word for jam. So we'd said we'd love to have it. And we ended up with these tubs of stuff that we couldn't eat. But we stayed 5 weeks in this flat, and we met Quinto and his wife and daughter on many occasions. To us, they were very brave people indeed. They'd moved into the country as soon as the emergency came. They came in to see us occasionally, but of course, if they had been caught, that whole family would have been executed, without a doubt.
Do you mean to say then that you were stuck in the flat solidly?
5 weeks.
Couldn't get out.
Yeah, we did get out, actually, on odd occasions, but only on very odd occasions. Now, we had there was a window of the lounge overlooked one of the busiest main streets in Modena, and we sat there most of the day, behind net curtains, watching the trams go by. And the people, we got to know people quite well. 11 o'clock, there was a haggard blonde